From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. The headlines out of Ukraine continue to be dire. Russia has been raining artillery fire on Kyiv, part of a violent campaign that has increasingly included attacks on civilian targets, including a maternity hospital. Back in the U.S., the government continues to weigh how to respond. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is scheduled to make a virtual address to Congress tomorrow. Meanwhile, senators are preparing for next week's confirmation hearings on Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, who's been nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court. Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin is an important figure in both of those stories, and he joins us now. Senator Durbin, welcome back to The 21st Show.
Good to be with you.
Listeners, if you want to join our conversation, the number today is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. Senator, I want to begin. Yesterday, you called for Russian President Vladimir Putin to be prosecuted for war crimes. Why?
We see it every night on television. To think that this innocent country, unprovoked Russian invasion, is killing innocent people, destroying these beautiful cities, forcing people out of their homes. You know, they estimate 3 million refugees from Ukraine at this moment. To put that in proportional context, it would be as if in 20 days, we would be forced to evacuate the population of Texas from the United States. That's what they're going through. This devastation is being brought on them by the individuals, I'm sorry to say, who is ranking as the worst war criminal of the 21st century.
One of the problems that the experts say is that Putin thinks the West is out to get him, right? He reportedly viewed video footage of Gaddafi's death in a drainage ditch over and over and over again. Is calling for war crime charges counterproductive to resolving this war?
Well, I wish it were a novel idea and I could claim credit for it, but it was underway. At The Hague, they're already receiving evidence from the Ukrainians and others for an investigation for this purpose. But I will just tell you, Vladimir Putin's paranoia is no excuse for killing innocent people, for bombing maternity hospitals and children's hospitals. It's an outrage to think that that strategy, which he seems to glory in, is still even possible in the 21st century.
Is there any resolution to this war that does not end with Putin in The Hague that would be acceptable to you, to the American government, to NATO, to the Ukrainian people that you've spoken with?
That decision is not going to be made in Moscow or in Washington or any European capital other than Kyiv itself. The people of Ukraine, through their elected leaders, have to decide when and if this conflict will end, if it's within their power.
Last week on the program, on this show, we spoke with Ambassador Ian Kelly, who, as you know, was State Department spokesman under the Obama administration, later ambassador to Georgia. He's at Northwestern now as an ambassador in residence, and he's among a number of former American diplomats who've called for limited no-fly zones over humanitarian corridors in Ukraine. What do you think of that idea?
Well, I tell you, I want to defer to the experts, and they have briefed us over and over again. When you say no-fly zone, you are basically saying we are going to enforce it. And enforcing that runs the possibility that we will be confronting Russian aircraft, for example, and the fear that if they're struck down and to crash and die, that that is going to be a precipitate event for even widening this war, possibly World War III or worse. So I'm going to defer to the military experts at this point. I want to be careful that we give all the assistance we can to Ukraine, but not expand this war beyond its boundaries or beyond the conventional warfare that we're seeing.
You mentioned earlier the number of refugees. I was currently estimated, I saw 2.8 million yesterday, 3 million perhaps today. The Department of Homeland Security heeded a call from you and others to grant temporary protected status to Ukrainian citizens already in the U.S. And yesterday on the show, we spoke with an Illinois State University doctoral student whose daughter and granddaughter fled the city of Dnipro and are currently in the Netherlands. She said she was encountering a lot of red tape trying to figure out if she could bring them here. Should the U.S. be doing more to take in Ukrainian refugees or at least allow them in?
Yeah, absolutely. And not just Ukrainian refugees. I made this point at a gathering of Irish Americans over St. Patrick's Day weekend in Chicago. These are refugees who look a lot like most of us white folks, but there are refugees from around the world who may have a different color skin or a different background, but need just as much compassion and care. So I hope that this will remind us of our obligation in the humanity of this universe to being there when other people need us. Special praise to the people of Poland and Hungary and Romania and Moldova who are opening their borders to the Ukrainian refugees. The ambassador from Poland was in for a meeting that I called last week, and he said, you'll notice there are no refugee camps in Poland. The people from Ukraine come in and are embraced and invited into the homes of Polish families. That is an amazing testament to their caring and compassion. We need to have the same attitude toward refugees in the United States.
What's the stumbling block to preventing us from doing that?
Politics. There's resistance on the other side of the aisle. Under President Trump, the number of refugees accepted in the United States went to all-time lows. They just don't care for them. And many of the folks on the other side of the aisle are not the least bit reluctant to say so. But, you know, when a country like Ireland, for example, to go back to the St. Patrick's Day gathering, one of their officials told me, we have 5 million people in Ireland, and we're accepting 100,000 refugees from Ukraine. You know, that to me is a testament to the kind of people they are and the values they have. I think at the heart of it, the United States shares those values.
Forgive me, I know Springfield government better than I do what, you know, the particulars in Washington, but it is a Democratic administration now in the Biden administration, and the Democrats do have slim majorities in Congress. Couldn't more be done just with that amount of power as it is now, or is this a filibuster issue or what?
Well, at this point, it can be done and should be done. There's no excuse for bureaucratic delay, whoever the president may be. But I wish our attitude, point I'm trying to make, I wish our attitude toward refugees returned to where it was for many decades under presidents of both political parties. And Ukraine is a reminder of needy people who will never forget the kindness that we can extend to them.
Given how polarized just about everything has become in America, and given the former president's comments favorable to Putin, at least early on in the war, are you surprised that the government response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine has not been more polarized along party lines, certain television news hosts notwithstanding?
Well, I'm glad you made that last exception. There are some outrageous Putin whisperers still on the media, and I'm not going to name names unless you want me to. I think most people know what I'm talking about. But, you know, I think there's a genuine feeling here that this is a return to a chapter in history that we thought was long gone. When the Polish ambassador talked about taking in refugees in his country, in the homes of Polish families, he said, we're doing this because in 1939, we had nowhere to go ourselves. They were invaded by the Nazis and paid a heavy price for it in human life and suffering. And the same thing is true now as we look at the situation in Europe. I think people in both political parties realize that this is a watershed moment. We are either going to stand up to this dictator, Vladimir Putin, or he's going to continue his rampage through Europe. He started testing us with Georgia and parts of Ukraine, and God forbid he's got his eye on the Baltic states. Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia is his next target. We've got to stop him now.
Just a reminder to listeners, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with senior Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, a Democrat. 800-222-9455 is the number if you want to join our conversation. If you have a question for the senator, it's rare our schedules align and he's able to join us live. So please do call in 800-222-9455 if you have a question for Senator Durbin. I want to pivot to the confirmation hearings for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson for a seat on the Supreme Court of the United States. It's kind of a remarkable statement on the times in which we're living that this story is no longer really on the front pages, but Judge Jackson would be the first Supreme Court justice with significant experience representing indigent criminal defendants, I think since Thurgood Marshall. How do you think that might influence the court's decisions in the years ahead?
Well, I think it brings some balance to the court. Every lawyer who's working in a courtroom will tell you that there are two tables, a prosecutor's table and a defense table. If you have competent counsel at both, you get the best result, the fairest result. And so we should give opportunities, as we have in the past, to prosecutors who have proven their skill. And we should give the same opportunities to those at the defense table who understand it from that perspective. It brings some balance and thinking to the court, and I think that Judge Jackson has really proven throughout her career that she can bring some balance based on her life experience.
I know public accessibility of the court has been an issue important to you over the years, allowing cameras in there. Do you plan to press her on that point?
That point is likely to be raised. I don't know if I'll have the opportunity, and it should be, because I really think that we need to bring the Supreme Court into this century. And the current system we have of radio broadcast and delayed broadcast otherwise is archaic. It is time that people see the Supreme Court in real time and draw their own conclusion about the justices. Take the mystery out of the court and make it accessible to the American public. I think that is a really good step in the advancement of justice.
And ultimately, though, Judge Jackson is going to be one of three liberal voices, you know, so-called liberal voices on the court. It's a 6-3 conservative majority, it seems, on most issues these days. Should Democrats, you know, looking to make policy, be looking beyond the court or finding a way to, you know, alter the court's jurisdiction? I mean, we've had this conversation a number of times over the years now.
Well, there's been a lot of speculation about what the court might look like in the future. The number of justices on the Supreme Court is not mandated by the Constitution, and it's changed from time to time in our history. I'm not suggesting to pack the court or increase the court size. When they raised that question on the floor of the Senate, I said there's only one senator who's had anything to do with mandating the size of the court, and that was Senator McConnell, who intentionally left a vacancy on the court for almost a year after Justice Scalia died. If you'll remember, he rejected Merrick Garland, who was President Obama's nominee, said he wouldn't even meet with him. And so he mandated that the court for a year would operate with eight justices. I'm not suggesting we move in that direction. And I'll just put in the political reality. I don't believe there is a bipartisan sentiment to change the court's jurisdiction at this point. So this is pure speculation. It's something that comes up frequently from the Republican side. One point that I'm kind of clinging to is that historically, when the court looks lopsided, it turns out finding a middle course. Some justices may move toward the center when they see these extremes currently on the court.
People can Google a switch in time that saved nine. I want to go to the phones now. Amy is calling in from Springfield. Amy on line four, thank you for calling in.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Durbin, for taking my question, and thank you for everything you do for the state of Illinois. My question is just if you could elaborate a little bit as far as you address this, the Ukraine refugee issue, as far as refugees being able to come into the United States. You had said that it's somewhat of a partisan issue, but as a constituent that would like to advocate for Ukrainian refugees to be brought in, allowed into the country, I would like a little more clarification on what we can advocate to move that process forward.
All right. Thank you for that.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks for the kind words. And let me tell you, it comes down to several things. First is each president sets a standard of how many people he will accept as refugees in the course of a year. It's rare that they ever accept that number in its totality, but at least it's an aspiration. That number under President Trump went down to some of the lowest levels in modern history. So we have to have some accommodation in our refugee numbers for cases just like Ukraine. Secondly, there are emergency circumstances, of course, where they can waive some of the requirements, at least on a temporary basis. And third, the ordinary course of events requires refugees to literally go through a background check that can take years, literally years, with interviews involved in a war situation such as Ukraine. That's not practical, nor should we impose it. So we're looking for humanitarian relief immediately, and perhaps refugee status leading to asylees in the near future. I would say to you, if you can reach out to colleagues and friends, fellow churchgoers, for example, and if they share your views and are willing to initiate a process to accept refugee families, let me know. You know, I'll do everything I can to expand that opportunity for you.
All right, just about a minute left in our conversation, and I don't want to forget about the pandemic, even though I think many of us are trying to forget about the pandemic. There have been reports about the possibility of a 9/11 style commission investigating what went wrong in our response to the pandemic. Where are you on this idea?
I think we should. I think we ought to establish the answers to that, and it will help guide us in the future. Here's the reality. COVID-19 is not gone. I wish that it were. Variants may emerge that challenge us just as much as we've been challenged before, and we have to be prepared for it. I'm sorry that there was a breakdown in the appropriations last week. We wanted to put together a special fund for that purpose. We failed in doing so. I think we need to revisit it and do it soon. Secondly, God forbid, there's going to be another pandemic. I don't know if it'll be in my lifetime, 10 years or 20 or 2 years, but they've been happening with some frequency and regularity, and we ought to be prepared to protect America as much as possible if that occurs. There have been breakthroughs. The vaccine breakthroughs with COVID-19 have given us guidance on where we might go if another pandemic emerges. Mm-hmm. But all of these things argue for knowing exactly what happened, what transpired, what were the strengths and weaknesses in America as we address this issue, and how can we learn from them to protect our kids and grandkids in the future.
Senator Durbin, thank you for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you very much, too.
More to come after a short break. Stay with us.